to North America. And in the last century, in the 20th century, this led to a lot of various conflicts because we see that the people of the African descent are different in nature and their quality than the people, the white races that came from Europe. So we had race riots and so on like that. And the ruling powers, they've tried or attempted to mitigate these differences by saying that we should all learn how to live together. What do they call it? They have a particular word for it. Not integration, there's something else.
Multicultural.
Yes, that's it. Multicultural, right? And so they're trying to train everybody that we should celebrate these differences rather than view them with suspicion. Of course, this is challenging for people who are mired mostly in the modes of passion and ignorance, because in the mode of passion, the result, rather, of the mode of passion is that a person views other people as different than himself. So we'll see people of different sex, people of different skin color, people of different cultural habits, that these people are, they see them not only as different from themselves, but they may view them with suspicion. In America, we had one author of children's group, children's books, Dr. Seuss. Anybody know of Dr. Seuss? Yeah. So Dr. Seuss wrote some very interesting books, and some of his books were actually more for adults than for children. He wrote one book called The Butter Battle Book. Did you read that one? So the Butter Battle Book is about two countries, neighboring countries, that view each other with great suspicion, because in one country, of course, they're very civilized, and like any normal person would do, they put the butter on the top side of the bread, right, and eat it in a civilized fashion like that. But the people on the other side of the border, something's wrong with them, because they put the butter on the bottom side of the bread, thinking that the butter tastes better than the bread, and that before it will contact the tongue first. So the story goes on to explain how these two neighboring countries, viewing each other with great suspicion because of these cultural differences, then wound up in a battle. This is a very comical commentary on the nature of this world, because we often see things like that. Now, of course, many places, well, let's see, here in Europe, of course, is very multicultural, and it's been that way for quite some time. And so I don't see, at least from my outsider's perspective, it's difficult for me to see the kind of conflict that we have between different groups in America. But even what to speak of different skin color, then, you know, in America we have the left coast, right, otherwise known as the West Coast, where all the people in California and so on, they're kind of kooky because they're very liberal in their ideas. And so the people on the East Coast also view them with suspicion. So the effort, these are natural differences between people because of the gunas. They see things in a different way. They view the world in a different way. They behave differently, and very naturally so. And so the effort to try to integrate these people is, as long as people are mired in Rajagun and Tamagun, this cannot be successful. It can be, people can pay lip service to it because we are, being indoctrinated to think that we should respect other people, of course, and so on. And it goes so far, but ultimately it cannot be successful. About almost 20 years ago, there was one American wrote a book, Samuel Huntington, wrote a book called Clash of Civilizations. And in this book, he predicted that future wars would not be fought between various nation states, but they would be fought between different cultural groups. Now, that person, he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, if you know who that is. And so many think that this was not a prediction as much as a prescription of how the people in the world should be managed. Council on Foreign Relations is a so-called think tank, which in which many of the country's political leaders belong to. But all of their meetings are, of course, they have a private agenda. And then they get into all this conspiracy stuff. But the point is that it's very easy to manipulate people, to whip them up and to make them cast, you know, a suspicion on each other. I was very amazed, actually, in 1991, I think it was, just prior to the outbreak of the first war in Iraq, of the propaganda that was being made. I mean, to me, it seemed like blatant propaganda that was being made against the Iraqis with no foundation, really. And prior to that war, they were playing on the like the History Channel and other channels. They were playing all these movies about World War II and so on like that. And they were basically trying to whip up the people into a war fever so that they could justify their attack on Iraq, so that people could say, yes, we should go to war with Iraq. And they're doing now the same thing, of course, with the country of Iran. And, of course, most people are easy to manipulate because the majority of the population are of a Sudra nature. Sudras, by their nature, they don't have such discriminating intelligence with which to understand the facts as they are, but rather they behave more on sentiment, and whatever the political leaders may tell them, they're apt to believe. And so, I don't know what the statistics are, actually, but you know, a great number of American people think that, yes, we should go start a war with Iran for some reason. But they do the same thing, right? They have, for example, with the World Trade Center in 2001, the men who supposedly did that act were of Saudi descent, but nonetheless, the United States decided to use that as an excuse to go to war with Iraq. So that kind of that detail somehow missed most of the people, but they used it as an excuse to whip up the sentiment against the Iraqis. Anyway, these things go on like that. In a responsible government, in a God-conscious government, these natural boundaries are used to divide people according to their nature so that their minds won't be disturbed and they can live in harmony. But the demonic rulers of today, they have a different agenda. Also, yeah, so in earlier verse, there was a statement that one island is divided into four places, and or no, let me see, let me find that. Yes, the inhabitants of those islands are also divided into four castes: Mitavrata, Satyavrata, Dhanavrata, and Anuvrata, which exactly resemble Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. They practice pranayama and mystic yoga, and in trance they worship the Supreme Lord in the form of Vayu. So, again, by the influence of the gunas, generally there's four types of people: Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Sudra. And in a God-conscious culture, the rulers, the kings, they would organize people according to these divisions. And there was a social contract between these various social orders. The social contract was that those with more ability were obligated to assist, to help those with less ability. And in this way, the social machine functioned very nicely. but today we have exactly the opposite situation, where the ruling powers, that they use their, not just the ruling powers, anybody with with a greater advantage. They use that advantage to exploit others of less ability or less intelligence. So we see that even the governments are exploiting the people. The people in the stock markets, the banking system, they are exploiting the people. The Weishaupt's manufacturing facilities, they're exploiting the people. And so because of this, then the people, ultimately they get fed up and they want to make a revolution. When I was traveling in Eastern Europe before, I would ask the devotees if they were, which was better, the capitalist system that they have now or the communist system that they had previously. And the general reply was that we're being exploited under either one. This doesn't really make much difference. So it's just, you know, the appearance may be different, but the result is that we're being exploited. So this is the nature of Kali, that the people are simply being taken advantage of. So ultimately, Prabhupada explains that the people, they will revolt, they will overthrow everything, but because they're Shudra by nature, they don't know what to do. So we see this in the recent protests, right? These Occupy protests around the world, where they're protesting the disparity, the great disparity that the 1% has so much wealth compared to the other 99%. But the problem is that these protesters, they didn't have any agenda. They're just angry that the way things are. So, and then people would ask, "So, okay, do you have a proposal for something better?" No. No proposal. So this is kind of what we might expect to see in the future, that the people, tired of being frustrated, being exploited, they will overthrow the ruling powers, but then not having any suitable intelligence, they have nothing to put in its place, and then everything descends into anarchy or local tribes or local clans or something like that that maybe fight and war with each other. So this is the unfortunate influence of Kali, how things become more and more degraded and people become more and more divided. So what's needed, of course, is a system, a social system, by which everyone can properly relate to each other. This is called Vanashram Dharma. The system of Vanashram Dharma is, again, a social contract that obligates each order to the other orders and based on principles of religion. Not based on laws that can be broken or evaded, but based on principles of religion for a culture that understands their spiritual nature and desires to uplift themselves. They understand that there's more than just this life, and that after this life, that they should use this life to prepare for the hereafter, for the next life. So we have to reestablish this Vanashram system. Prabhupada was very, very eager to do this. He wanted, for example, a Vanashram college to be established in every temple. Of course, that instruction hasn't been carried out because, to be honest, most devotees really didn't understand it at that time, and perhaps many still don't. This is what we have to do. The Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Gita, is explaining these things, and we have to understand this for the benefit of all the people of the world. Prabhupada wanted to create a brahminical class of men who would look after the welfare of the entire society. The praja. So the brahmanas, they're not simply supposed to be just self-interested, thinking of their own benefit, but they're supposed to be looking after the welfare of the entire population. And they're thinking about how they can be lifted up. So this is also our desire to help reestablish this system. What we might call neo-vanashram, or more modern vanashram, Many times devotees become confused when there's discussion of Anasram because the thought is that we would try to establish Vanashram as it was formerly being run, that is, with demigod worship and dharma, artha, kama, moksha, etc. But why should we do that? Because Krishna, he's given us a different way of worship in Bhagavad Gita. Pritta naya saranam vinashayat sadushkritam. He's come again to establish the principles of religion. And the principle of religion that he's established in Bhagavad Gita is devotional service. And this, is, of course, has been handed down and refined for us in the sadhana given to us by our acharyas. Shri Hare Krishna. What are the names of your deities, Prabhu? What are the names of your deities?
Gopal.
Gopal. Gopal Kijai. we have to actually take the principle of Anasram, take the ideas of this cooperation between the social orders, and combine it with the practice of bhakti yoga, in what we would call then Daiva Vanashram, spiritual Vanashram. Previous Vanashram was what we might call the long method, took many, many, many lifetimes to achieve perfection. And even still at that point, the persons would only be liberated to Vaikuntha. But now, with the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, everyone has the opportunity to achieve the loving relationship with Lord Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan. So, Nil Vanashram, or Daiva Vanashram, should be oriented like this, to bring everyone closer and closer to Krishna. This Vanashram can be explained in a very simple way, based on Bhagavad Gita. If we look at chapter 12 in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is explaining the hierarchy, or let's say a descending principles. He says, best is to offer everything to me. If you can't do that, follow the regulative principles of bhakti yoga. If you can't do that, then surrender everything to me. If you can't do that, then give up some of the results of your activities. If you can't do that, then do meditation. And if you can't do that, then cultivate knowledge. Interestingly, this is, if you take these slokas in the reverse order, this then becomes, we can see the process by which most of us came to Krishna consciousness. That we received a book from somebody. We're cultivating knowledge, then we come to the temple, and somebody instructs us to chant japa. So we take up then meditation. Then we may begin to give some donation to the temple, giving up some of the results of our work for Krishna, and then maybe even coming doing full-time service in some way, and then finally taking up the regulative principles of bhakti yoga. So this is, in one sense, we could say this is the process of Vanashram Dharma, by which a crude man is turned into a pure devotee of the Lord. And Prabhupada states on one occasion that this is the purpose of Vanashram. So, you know, exactly how fast that process can take place varies from individual to individual. Some people, some devotees, they come to the temple the first time and they never leave. Others take years and years. And so it is for everyone. But if we arrange to look after the praja by having Vanashram colleges, we arrange that people, they can see that we're interested in their welfare. Not just so that they can come be part of our group and maybe be exploited. Of course, that concern's there for everyone. Now in America, I heard a statistic recently that, of course, most people, they're very They've had it with mainstream religions, or organized religion. And so in America, some 40% of the people, they want to be spiritual but not religious. Religious means to belong to some, you know, organized form of religion, Judeo-Christian generally. And people are, they're very, they don't have much faith in that because they see that these things are, these institutions are being used for exploitation. But rather they're looking for spiritual principles. How can I be spiritual? This should give us a very important clue about how to preach. That people are looking for religious or spiritual principles. What does it mean? Oh yeah, another statistic that's very interesting to go along with that is that around the year 2000, I read that some 60% of people in America had the understanding that they are not the body. That they, you know, were some kind of spiritual being. Now, exactly what that meant, perhaps they don't really know. But that's an amazing statistic, considering that when I joined the movement in 1973, at that time, Srila Prabhupada was the only one who was very clearly stating that you're not the body. Nobody else at that time was saying such a thing. But since then, there have been many different books about near-death experiences. There was a very popular television show in America called Crossing Over, where the host was some kind of psychic who could connect with the deceased relatives and speak on their behalf to the descendants. Did you see that ever? And that became very popular. Everybody wanted to, you know, of course, they're attached to their long-lost relatives. And there was some things that would come across that you could tell that that he had actually some connection with these departed souls. So different things like that convince people that, yeah, that we're not the body, that there's something more going on. So then what's next? So this is then should be the stage of our preaching. It's what's next. What does it mean to be spiritual? What does spiritual mean? What do I, as a spiritual being, what do I do? How do I act as a spiritual being in this material world? Shishirada Gopinath Ki. In any case, so this is these things, understanding the sentiment of the people gives us a clue about where we can go with our preaching to be successful. I had the opportunity to speak at a economics conference in Copenhagen prior to coming here. It was a conference on the post-green economy. And in attendance, there was about 400 people. And many of those were the Occupy people. So this is the first opportunity I had to have some immediate contact with some of these Occupy people. And I found that they're hungry for leadership. They don't know what to do. They want something different. They look at their future. They don't see a future for themselves. And they have nobody to tell them what to do. Hello. This is our call. This reminds me of the 60s and 70s in the West when there was the same situation. The young people, they looked at what was going on in the world. They didn't see a future for themselves, and they were looking for some alternative. And just at that time, of course, Prabhupada came on the scene, and the Hare Krishna movement was born, and we made great strides at that time. Thousands of young people joined. So the situation is coming up again where we have such a similar opportunity. The social economic circumstances of the world today are creating an environment where people are looking for leadership. So this is our cue to step up and provide that leadership. We have to show not just spiritual knowledge, but we have to show them how to survive independent of the status quo. Because people see that the status quo no longer serves them. And of course, this is more extreme in places like Spain and Greece. But it's coming to a neighborhood near you. These things are not going to be solved. These economic problems are not going to be solved. In fact, if anything, they're going to become worse. And what we're going to see is that the fallible soldiers that people depend on to give them shelter in this world, the government, money, whatever it is, all of their fallible soldiers are going to be removed, and they're going to not know where to go for shelter. So this is creating a wonderful opportunity for the Hare Krishna movement to again take up preaching, to give an alternative to this Uga Karma civilization, show people how to live a natural life independently, living on the land, where there's, if we learn how to do that, there's no chance of an economic debacle. And at the same time, make progress in spiritual life. Anyway, so I'll stop there. Comments or questions? So temples are for Brahmins, and so what does it mean, Varnashram College? As I was explaining, the Varnashram system is a social contract. There used to be formerly a social contract in which the people, the peasants, they were owed their protection and their maintenance by the lords. I don't know what it went on in this building, but, castles like this, they used to have barons and lords who had a lot of peasants working for them. And there was a social contract that they would serve the lord, and in exchange, they would receive both protection against, invaders, and their sustenance, at least to a minimum degree. That was changed about 300 or 400 years ago, and I explained that in my book, how the powers that be decided that they wanted to get people to work in factories and off of the land, and so the social contract was broken. It worked okay for some time, as long as people were able to find some jobs, but now we're coming to the point where not only is the social contract broken, but we can say that the powers that be actually have the intention of impoverishing the middle class. This economic debacle in 2008 was deliberately created. You can read that how that was done on my website and a paper I wrote called Economic Chernobyl. Anyway, people, they don't have any shelter. What are they going to do? So it's not that you can just put people together and everything's going to work out. And a lot of people have this idea. For example, in developing of intentional communities, one time I was in Warsaw, and the devotees there, they wanted to tell me about their plans for developing a community. And they wanted to show me the land that they were going to buy, and I said, well, you see, pick one picture of some land, that land looks like land, Not really interested in that, but instead, tell me who are your leaders and what's your ideology? And they said, well, we're not going to have any leaders, we're just all going to live together, and we don't really have any ideology. So I suggested, well, don't start then, because it's not going to be successful. There must be a common understanding of what we're doing. Culture, this culture works because we all carry around in our heads the same understanding of it. And if we're going to try to create a different culture, then we have to have a common understanding of what their culture is. So Vanashram culture is meant to explain how we're going to function different socially in different circumstances. So how will economic decisions be made? How will people be provided for? How will healthcare be taken care of? So many things like this. Vanashram Dharma is basically, it's a society of mutual dependence where we each take care of each other. And more like a clan or a large family where there's no buying and selling between the members, but a mutual exchange based on need or based on even love. So this culture needs to be promulgated, it needs to be taught. And so this is the idea of Vanashram College, to understand these principles, how we're going to live without the, let's say, the parameters of modern culture that give us social order. Basically, modern society is organized by money. And if a person has money, then they can hire others to accomplish their tasks, and people find their jobs, and everything goes on in this way. But there's many defects in this system. Prabhupada calls it Asurik Vanashram. Many defects because people are not properly situated, and therefore they can't properly grow. When I was here last time, I think I gave one lecture about finding our place, that we must all have a place in society. And that place is based on having work according to our guna and karma, or according to our nature, on having proper relationships with others, and having a place, a physical place, to take care of our body. Modern society, people can't find their place. It's very difficult. Therefore, we see that young men, not just young men, but you know, couples are not getting married until almost, or maybe even over, the age of 30 these days. Because a young man, he can't find his place in the world, therefore he doesn't feel secure in to be able to start a family. And it takes that long to figure out what the heck's going on because it's such a complicated place. And even still, many times, people, they can find a way to make money, but they can't really find a place that's appropriate so that they can grow. Unless we have a proper place, we can't grow. Human life is meant for growth. Just like Tulsi, she needs a proper environment. She needs, you know, there's a pot, there's a soil, and that soil has to be of a certain composition, and a certain amount of water and atmosphere and so on. When that environment is ideal, then she can grow nicely. It's the same thing for human beings. When we have a proper environment, when we have a proper place, then we can grow. We can grow emotionally, physically, spiritually, which is the main idea. To be able to develop spiritually through the entire life. So Vanashram Dharma is meant to create the environment in which all of this growth can take place. So that means the proper relationships with each other is very, very significant to that. If we leadership is required. We have this idea today that we don't need leaders, but without leadership we can't develop. Things can go on, but without leadership things can't grow. So we need leaders, and because this means what? This means dvija. This means the Vaishyas, Kshatriyas, Brahmanas. Those who have discriminating intelligence, who know what needs to be done, first, second, third, and who can guide others in proper productive activity. And each of these varnas, they have their place in the social order. It's a machine. It's basically a social machine. When the machine is assembled nicely, properly, then the machine can function very well. But today, the machine's all broken, and we got the wrong parts in the wrong places, and consequently, everything is becoming more and more degraded. Anyway, I'm sorry I got into a long-winded answer. Did that cover your question?
Well, I'm still wondering what this Varna Ashram calls. What is exactly?
Okay. So one sentence answer. To teach the principles of an alternative culture, an alternative spiritual culture to the people of this world so that they can learn how to function in the absence of the current culture.
So does it mean you need a separate building and like that where we teach sutras and bhashas and sutras and as opposed to
Yeah, in my conception, it wouldn't take place in the temple at all, no. It would be a separate location where people would be able to learn not just the spiritual subject matter that the Brahmins are interested in, but more or less, but more actually about how to provide for oneself. So, for example, the buzzword these days is eco-villages. There's a lot of eco-villages in the world. People are looking for an alternative way to live. And this means that you have to provide for yourself. The idea of the eco-village is that you minimize the use of money, you grow your own food, you produce your own necessities. So that those skills, that knowledge and skills has to be taught. So that's one function of the Dhanashram College. The other function of it is to explain the social arrangement, that how we can live happily in this world under the guidance of the instructions of the Supreme Lord and how he's arranged this creation. So that's the other half. So basically two halves like that. Prabhupada said like this, he said, first you establish Varna, and then when that's working nicely, then you can establish Ashram. Now Varna, not too difficult to do because basically means work. Everybody in this world, we work, we get a job, right? Then we go to work and we do our part, whatever that might be. So people are already familiar with the divisions of labor like that. They have bosses, they have managers and so on. And so this is not a contrary concept. It's very easy for them to accommodate that. We need to show how to do it in such a way so that we take care of each other rather than try to exploit each other. And then after that, then ashram, these principles of Bhagavad Gita, can be taught. Is that better? What do you think? Mark?
You mentioned you attended a conference in Copenhagen and share your thoughts with the congregation. What were the main points that you were presenting?
Oh. I have several opportunities for speaking engagements this year. One was at this conference. The other main speaker at this conference was a fellow. He wrote a book called Sacred Economics. And the organizers, the Occupy people who actually organized that conference, one of them was just coming to Krishna consciousness or learning about Krishna consciousness. And so the devotees then told them about my book about spiritual economics, and they became very excited then to invite me. I also have, in several weeks, I'll be speaking at London at the Association of Heterodox Economists at their conference, and then I speak again in Italy at the European Sociological Association. In all of these programs, what I'm presenting is economics as a function of consciousness, basically my book, and that if we want to solve the economic problem, we have to raise the consciousness. And I explain briefly the gunas and demonstrate that we are sliding down into tamaguna, And that if we want to actually solve the problems, we have to get more sattva and less tamas. Anyway, so that's what I'm presenting at all of these. Same idea.
Why is it that we how do you feel that we haven't been able to create a Vanashram balance?
Not clear on the concept. If you read the... Prabhupada didn't go into much detail about this in his purports. If we actually want to hear Prabhupada's instructions on this, we have to read his morning walk conversations and his room conversations, because that's where Prabhupada was instructing his leaders in the development of the society. He didn't put those kinds of things in the books. So unless we take the trouble to actually go find that, we won't really understand it. And in my experience, you know, most devotees, you know, they haven't done that for whatever reason. So, if you read, for example, the there's a very important room conversation, February 14th, 1977, in Mayapur. And in that conversation, Prabhupada's instructing the devotees, for example, that they should introduce Vanashram in ISKCON. And Hari Sari and the other devotees are there just like completely blown away by this idea. What? In ISKCON, but we're trying to train people to be Vaishnavas, so how are we going to introduce Vanashram? Prabhupada's reply was, it's not so easy to be Vaishnava. If it's so easy to be Vaishnava, then why so many are falling down? So therefore, Vanashram is meant to give people a place to come closer to the principles of bhakti yoga, but still have association. You know, in those days, there was no congregation. You were in or out, right? You're a full-time devotee in devotional service, so there was basically no place for you. We didn't have a congregation at that time. And so Prabhupada was, he was trying to make it clear that there needs to be some interim place where people can be, still have association, still be able to grow in Krishna consciousness, but not be expected perhaps to follow everything so strictly. In any case, the point is, let's say my perception of the problem is that we haven't understood it. It takes a lot of study. I mean, I got into this when I was at Gita Nagari in 1977. I was the treasurer there. And we had 30 cows in the barn milking. We had 30 oxen in the other barn eating. We had about 40 devotees there at the time eating. And most of that, and I was also the person who went into town to buy the boga, right? So I was buying the boga to supply the devotees who were living on the farm, and I went, something's wrong with this picture. And then at the same time, of course, this was the New York Temple farm, and the New York Temple was sending $10,000 a month for the maintenance of that farm. And so when I saw this situation, I said, this can't be what Prabhupada had in mind, you know, for these farms. And so I've been thinking about it ever since that, which is what's taken me into economics, because the economics of it is actually quite important. Prabhupada gave a number of instructions about that, that, you know, you go to there to live a simple life and to provide for yourself. But generally in our farm projects, we haven't followed that instruction, and in my opinion, that's why we had so many failures. Anyway, there's a lot to be said on it, and I don't want to just go on and on.
Wouldn't you understand it as the responsibility of leadership to establish national power?
Of course.
Merging into the existing.
let's try to be very generous here and fair. To run a temple is not an easy thing to do, even if you're focused on that full time, right? You know, you got to get the money, you got to make things happen. It's a challenge, it's a big challenge. And really, there's not much time left over to be thinking about what alternatives are there in Varnashram Dharma. It's just, you know, it's too much. And so there's a few, you know, we have a few leaders who are focused more on that than others. And the way I see it is, there'll be, you know, it has to be shown. Somebody actually has to demonstrate a successful example of that, and then others can take it up. Perhaps the best example that we have in the West is Sri Ramaswamy in the Hungry Farm. But even then, I don't know if you can call it Varnashram Dharma, or how close it is to Varnashram Dharma. But in time, this will all become clear. The point that I'm trying to make today is that given the changing circumstances in the world today, this is creating a huge opportunity for Krishna consciousness to take leadership and to give guidance to people. Because, like I said, these occupied people, they're hungry for leadership. Tell us what to do. There's nobody telling them what to do, you know. A lot of people came to hear the Sacred Economics Fellow. They didn't come to hear me so much. I mean, it was nice to be able to share the forum with him, but they came to hear him. But his ideas are, by and large, sentimental. Or he's trying to shift things around in the existing paradigm. Whereas I'm basically trying to crack that paradigm and show the fault of it on a spiritual level, and, you know, to suggest the real solution to it. Anyway, these things aren't going to change, you know, in a few years. There's a lot more changes that are going to go on. Yeah.
Is the Krishna Valley project the last, well, it's actually like that how it's Budapest, applied for a grant from the Norwegian government to establish a bachelor's and master's degree in sustainable living.
Yeah.
And if that goes through, it seems to me that a lot of the problems with the farm communities is that they don't really know what they were doing, you know, so they didn't have the skills to live on the land, they didn't have skills to grow their own food.
Right.
And, you know, if that's in place, if this training is in place, then it seems like there's a chance, you know, of actually establishing you know, proper communities where the Sishabasha principles follow. Because we're born in such a messy culture where there's very little skills to live in natural life.
Yeah. Yeah, we're alienated, you know.
One of the contagious people, at least, have the opinion that devotees should train people that are already living fairly close to that, you know. And still not.
There's a lot of devotees doing that in South India. There's not a lot, a number of them. They're going to villages. People are already in the village, and they're training them. There's one devotee went to a fishing village. He convinced them by preaching to stop fishing and start farming, and then later convinced them to start taking up cow protection. So it's going on, little by little. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's nice in India, but here in the West, you know, what do you got? 1-2% of the people live on the land, and everybody else, they don't have a clue, you know, what to do with a seed. Want to speak of everything else. So it's not an easy nut to crack. There's a lot to be done. When you have a good economy, Varnashram Dharma doesn't look very good. Right? But when you're living on the street and there's nothing, that might be a good option. Right? Somebody can show me how to take care of myself so at least I can eat and bathe. So a lot of this is, you know, the circumstance, the external circumstances create an environment for our success or failure. But I'm trying to point out that, because I, you know, for my service, I read a lot of economic stuff. And we have opportunity coming. Well, because economics it's just not going to work in the future. People are really going to be hung out to dry. Or they're going to be looking for some help, in my humble opinion. Thank you very much. Shilpa Bhadki.